in all honesty, I don't want to talk about it. But if you don't talk about it, if you don't talk about what went on yesterday, I don't think you deserve to have a talk show. Do you?
You know what? I'd agree with you on that.
It's even by the low standard by which we've become accustomed, yesterday was probably the darkest of days. If you watch the press conference that Donald Trump had, he just kept topping himself and topping himself and topping himself. And at some point you go, oh, it can't get any worse. And then it would get worse. Imagine a roller coaster that never came up. It just kept going downhill over and over and over and over.
And that would explain the sick feeling in my stomach.
Yeah. Yeah, it would.
It really would.
And can I tell you, even though, I mean, look, that press conference happened 20 hours ago, and anybody who saw it has commented on it at some point. And there was a lot to comment on. There were a lot of things that were said yesterday that you just, even if you were the most fervent of Donald Trump supporters, you had to scratch your head and go, oh, I'm not positive that was a good thing to say. That went on for quite a while yesterday. But then at the end of the press conference, as he's walking away and he starts to explain about his winery, his vineyard, and how great it is.
I know Charlottesville very well.
Yeah.
I have the world's largest. Yes.
Vineyards, which, by the way, was disproven by every website on the internet. They said, no, he owns one, but it's not the largest. Not that that's important, but he's just got this thing where he thinks, if I say it, it must be true because I'm Donald Trump. So I'll just say something, and there's no possible way anyone could look anything up to see if I'm telling the truth or not.
Steve, what was he originally scheduled to talk about?
Because it was about infrastructure, right. And he was there with Elaine Chao, I think she's transportation secretary. I apologize. And Mnuchin was there as well. But
yeah.
They were going to talk. He was going to give some opening statements about infrastructure, and then sort of blow out of there and let Mnuchin and Chao take questions about infrastructure.
But he had
instead
to know
he took the questions
with what was going on. That even though you could title it the infrastructure press conference, I don't remember there being a single question about the infrastructure.
Well, his staff did not expect him to take questions.
Right.
That's what happened. He went down there. The plan was, according to his staff, he wasn't going to take questions. Now, maybe he planned to all along, or he couldn't resist. I don't know.
I bet it's he couldn't resist. He cannot resist.
Yeah.
He wants to explain himself, you know, saying that what I said, the statement I issued, was fine.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that's remarkable, Wendy, and maybe Bill, you touched on this too, about yesterday, was usually when there's a big event or news conference, there is one or two bits of audio that define it.
Yeah.
And so then every subsequent newscast, you know, you hear the same two or three bits.
Yeah.
Yesterday, it was all that way.
The whole thing.
You're never hearing the sort of the same thing.
I mean,
you keep hearing different and different things because there wasn't one defining moment. The entire thing was a defining event.
Well, for me, if we could all pick our favorite hits from his album, his white album, one of them was him saying,
by the way,
there were fine people on both sides. I'm not 100% sure there were fine people on one of the two sides.
Jimmy Kimmel said it best. If you are a fine person and you see someone marching with swastikas and chanting about Jewish people, mm-hmm. and you stay with that side, mm-hmm. then you're not fine.
Yes.
The New York Post today has a headline that says they weren't all Nazis.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Right.
And, you know, when he was taking questions and he's like, okay, what else? He's just so snippy and rude. And then he's the one part I actually got sick to my stomach and laughed at the same time when he goes, okay, whatever. Fake news. What do you got? Fake news? Like, come on.
Right. At some point, he explained to the room full of press people that he's been watching this story in Virginia a lot closer than they have.
Yeah, I know.
Which, again, I'm not positive that's true. And how disturbing is it if you're Heather Heyer's mother and you have just been through this ordeal, this horrible, horrible ordeal of losing your daughter, you would almost expect a telephone call from Donald Trump. Good, bad, or indifferent, it's kind of part of the policy. It's his job to try to be reassuring under these circumstances. Not yet. It's coming. It hasn't happened yet. If you're her, if you're the mother of this woman, do you accept that phone call? I wouldn't. What could he possibly say to make any of this right?
And, you know, all the news sites now have a bunch of fake news checkers,
yeah.
you know. And one of it, I got to find it, about the Heather Heyer's mom calling or saying, you know, thank you for that. She said, yeah, she may have said that, but... she was in shock. It was like, yeah. you know, there was, she wasn't thinking correctly. I got to find that for you. Cause there's just, it just kills me that he will call a reporter just fake news.
Right.
And yet fact check his stuff. And
right.
really the people who right now continue to support him, please call us and tell us why. 312-981-7200. I just don't understand it.
At some point, you have to I think you have to realize, maybe I'm wrong, but I think most people, most sane people would realize, I have bet on the wrong horse. This horse
is
not...
It's okay to say that.
Right. Right. Of course it is. But it's...
But what do we do then? What do we do for someone who supported him and now says, I don't? I mean, what... We're all in it now.
Did you see these pictures of General Kelly during this? Now, General Kelly makes his bread and butter by being in wars. He has seen things.
His son was killed
in
the
military. This guy has seen everything and worse. And they show him yesterday during Donald Trump's speech just looking as forlorn as he could possibly be. Like, oh, this is not good. A lot of people said the day before yesterday, well, Donald Trump actually seemed kind of presidential. He finally said what he was supposed to say 2 days ago. But then they show Kelly yesterday like, oh, this is a hole you cannot dig yourself out of. His body language was just, his arms are folded. He's looking down. It's like, oh, this is not going to work.
It doesn't seem to be working. 312-981-7200. We put the call out there. You put the call in here. If you still support Trump, why? That's all. That's all we want to know. 312-981-7200. It's Bill. It's Wendy. It's 720 WGN.
It's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder. We're discussing Donald Trump's press conference yesterday and would love to get your thoughts, good, bad, or indifferent. We're here for you. We're at 312-981-7200.
Shall we talk to Colleen, Bill?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Wendy. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I would like to preface this by saying I do not agree with the alt-right at all. Mm-hmm. I think it's wrong. That being said, they were allowed legally to protest.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that one side was the whole instigator and the other side did not have something to do with it. I think Trump's right when he says that. I get kind of tired of it's always the right, always the right.
Yeah.
But when it goes the other way, when it's Ferguson, when it's someplace where the left, if you want to call it that, is tearing things up, well, then that's just, you know, because they've been oppressed and, you know, poor things.
You know, so, I was thinking about this last night, and there's a great HBO little excerpt. And we will post it on our Facebook page later on today. It's kind of a recap of the whole thing. And I was watching, the protesters and they were getting in the face of, the white nationalists. And I thought to myself, if this parade of tiki torches, which by the way, the Tiki Torch Company wants nothing to do with
this. It looks
this.
Like Pier One Imports is sponsoring the whole demonstration.
I mean, really.
I wouldn't want to be associated with that if it was me.
Well, let me ask you though.
Wait, can I just finish?
Yeah,
I was, if they were walking down our street, I would be up in their face too and say, get off my street.
Yeah.
I really would. You're trying to protect your community.
Right, but they were there legally.
Oh,
they had a
legal
parade permit. Well,
so
now, how can it be legal schmeagle? So when they're jumping up and down on cars and burning them and tearing them up and turning them over, that was okay.
I couldn't sit idly by while they were chanting such hatred. That's what would push me over the edge.
I totally agree with that. I do not agree with the hatred, but I don't agree with changing history. Now you have a pastor up there or preacher that came out an hour ago. He wants Washington Park name changed because that name for George Washington, and he was a slave owner.
We can't change history.
Where
you're absolutely right. But there's a difference between
changing history and honoring the misdeeds of the past, you know?
I don't consider it honoring. It's just, you know, they toppled a statue of a young boy. Now, it was not even, you know, a named person or whatever. It was just was somebody that was in that time frame and fought in the Civil War.
And do you topple a statue, or do you try to start a movement to get your local government to remove it? I don't know.
Well, I think, there should be a dialogue about it. It shouldn't just be people...
I can't have a dialogue with people, though, that are chanting that hate. How do you have a dialogue?
I understand that. Totally. But, you know, ISIS is guilty of doing the same thing by just tearing things down and not even... So are we getting to that point?
But ISIS was eradicated, right? Trump said he was going to take them down. He did, right?
Yeah.
I missed that.
Well, yeah, I know.
You're comparing this to ISIS?
Well, I'm comparing the mob mentality of it to ISIS.
It's actually almost easy to connect the dots between what just happened in ISIS. It almost is. I mean, it's local. It's a locally grown form of ISIS, but it's similar. There's other calls we need to take, Colleen, but thanks. We appreciate your call. We appreciate your
opinion. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we were able to talk without yelling at one another, correct?
Yeah, so far.
All right, shall we talk to Chuck real quickly?
Yes.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi, guys. First of all, let me say that I agree with Colleen on most of everything that she said. That most everything that people say about Trump, I agree with. I certainly didn't vote for him. I don't agree with the far right. I think those people are, you know, just insane and an embarrassment to this country. However, Trump is the only one so far that has called out the left on this. And we know, we see them when they show up for these demonstrations with their Guy Fawkes masks on and their hoods and masks, other types of masks. These people come prepared to do battle, too. And we don't know who threw the first punch here. But somebody needs to say something about the far left, too. And that's pretty much all I have to say.
I would like to throw out there, if you're on the Internet today and you want to take a break during work, look up this Vice News. There's a young reporter who is she's basically embedded with some of these white nationalists asking questions. And it didn't make me angry. It made me sad and made me want to throw up. It's great coverage. Would you agree to that?
It's amazing coverage. She's in a very dangerous place. And this is just the events that just happened over the weekend. And she's there. Remind me of her name. It's L something.
Yeah,
I can't remember what her last name is.
But you
know what it all boils down to is there's a tweet that Barack Obama sent out the other day saying that nobody's born hating anybody else. That's learned behavior. And it's true. When you're a baby,
I think that was a Nelson Mandela.
Yes,
it is. Retweeted.
It's absolutely true.
Which I retweeted too, because it is the most retweeted tweet ever, which is also pissing off Donald Trump.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry,
I know.
But Chuck, it's the young reporter. She seems like so very young. Her name's Elle Reeve.
Yeah.
And just watch Vice News. It's a video. It's on HBO on Fridays, and they put this little newsreel together, and it documents the timeline of everything, and it just, I think everybody should see this. I really do. So Chuck, check it out, and thank you very much for calling. We appreciate it.
Okay, all right, you guys have a good day.
Thanks, Chuck. I enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir.
All right, we'll continue this discussion to some extent. We've had Tom Mikitas on with us before. He's a professor over at DePaul University. He's a terrorism expert. We'll discuss the events that took place over the weekend and what's ahead. That's coming up in just a little bit. So stay here. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN. Wendy, before we introduce Tom Mikitas, just a quick text. We got a lot of texts, some pros, some cons, some in the middle about our discussion over the last half hour about Donald Trump's press conference yesterday. You had mentioned that if you really want to see an interesting take on this, there's a show called Vice or Vice News that runs on HBO. Elle Reeve is the reporter on this particular episode, and what she does is she kind of embeds herself with the white supremacists that work together over the weekend and asks them some what I think are extremely penetrating questions about their motives. Why are you doing this, and what's going on that got you here? I think she does a great job at it, and somebody texted in, Vice News is your source. How reliable? if you watch this, if you just spend the 23 minutes watching it, well, yeah, there are many sources, but since you cited Vice, and I will back you up on it because I watched the exact same episode last night, watch it, because all she does is asks the questions and lets them run with it. The guys who run the White House really doesn't have an opinion on this. Not really.
The guy said he thought it was a victory for them this weekend because none of them was killed and
right.
just one of the other people was killed.
And he said the reason that that poor young girl, Heather Heyer, was killed and the reason some of them got injured, and I might be paraphrasing, but something like, you know, they're idiots. They didn't know to move out of the way of a car.
Right. He referred to the people that they were protesting against as animals.
Yep.
Yeah. So I will not only back you up, but I'll double down on this. It is an extremely reliable source. All this woman, L. Reeve, is doing is asking the leaders of the white supremacist group, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? What happened? And they're taking the rope and hanging themselves. So,
and showing all their guns, the one guy, yeah. the leader of one of the groups, who this started as a bunch of memes, and they just wanted to get out and protest. Donald Trump has said it's because of the Confederate statues, which they said at the beginning, maybe, but they wanted to make a movement. They wanted to take it from the internet. And I got to be honest with you, I'm shocked at all the people that were participating with the tiki torches.
There was a lot.
I mean, that
there were a lot of people there.
It was jaw dropping
yeah.
to me.
Yeah. No
so
doubt.
Terrorism, you be the judge, but we have a terrorism expert on, historian and author and a DePaul professor, Tom Mikaitis. Welcome back, Tom. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How about you?
I don't know what to think anymore. I really just don't.
Okay. I can understand that.
Tom, in the past, we've kind of gone over this with you, but now I guess it needs to be redefined again. What does and what does not constitute terrorism?
Well, the key to determining it is, first of all, we generally accept it as violence perpetrated by non-state actors in the service of an ideology, an extremist ideology. And that's why I pull these domestic attacks. Now, certainly they are not premeditated or planned. They're what we fit the pattern, what we call lone wolf. But that doesn't excuse the fact that the extremist organizations spit this vitriol. They create this intense context of ideological hatred. And they know perfectly well that there will be people who will act on this. I mean, if you look at Vanguard America, the group that he had the shield from, they claim he wasn't a member. You know, it's this incredibly racist thing. And then in the bottom, it has this disingenuous disclaimer saying, "Oh, but we do not, you know, advocate lawlessness, et cetera, et cetera." I mean, it's like the Nazis saying, you know, we hate Jews, but on the other hand, we're not in favor. You know, we're not telling you to go out and actually hurt them.
So when they throw out a disclaimer like that, though, what's the purpose of that disclaimer? We all know what's right and what's wrong. So why that disclaimer?
The disclaimer is that they're walking a fine line between openly inciting violence, which might be legally actionable, and creating a climate that encourages it. And I think that's the thing that's going on here. Now, the thing that's also important to recognize, historically, this isn't new. I mean, there was a lot of, in fact, actually, racial violence was much worse in the heyday of the Ku Klux Klan. The unfortunate thing is these attitudes have become closer to the mainstream. They've been legitimized. People have come out in the open with them because they feel like that this has been some way that this has been acceptable as part of legitimate discourse.
My big question to you, Tom, is just because we are for other races and religions, just because we want to welcome that into our country, how in the world does that make us anti-white?
Yeah, well, I think that's very, very well said. This is not a rational thing. There's a visceral fear of loss of control and identity. The analysts have said it very well. The issue of the statues is not the statues, except these went up in the 50s, the 60s, not as part of real history, but as part of a reassertion of white dominance in the face of a growing civil rights movement. The real fear is that people have a fear of change. Is that if you look at the demographics of America, we're becoming a wonderfully rich rainbow nation, a tapestry of diverse races, religions, ethnicities, and so on. And these people find that somehow just profoundly threatening. And the sad thing is they're looking back to an imaginary when it was better kind of thing. And the bitter irony is that, you know, many of these people, you know, are not particularly well off and so on. But that's due to things that are not related to race or immigration or anything else.
So are they preyed upon a little bit because of that? I mean, I know there's a growing movement online to recruit people who are exactly what you described, yeah, a little bit on the downside so that somebody sees an in to get to them. That's by design, isn't it?
Well, you know, I'm actually working on a new terrorism book, and a big part of it's going to be looking at this issue of radicalization. And I'm struck by how similar the way these people recruit and the way ISIS recruits is. But in both cases, what you construct is what's called a grievance narrative. And that narrative is cobbled together with some real unhappiness and a perceived imaginary scapegoated other. And then you create with it an empowerment narrative. One, you're being persecuted. And two, you can do something about it. Now, the good thing is 90% of the people who buy into either or both of those narratives really never do engage in violence, but it doesn't matter. It creates the environment in which just enough of them actually do. So, and the thing is that the internet is a game changer because on the one hand, it both isolates and connects you. It isolates you from the immediate reality around you. And on the other hand, it creates a virtual community of people who tell you your views are really not extreme, they're mainstream. And that's a particularly pernicious thing.
I, first of all, want to say this completely truthful. I do not agree with President Trump's statement on both sides are to blame. I will, however, say that, and we spoke about this a little earlier, I did see the protesters getting more violent, flipping off the white nationalists. But then I try to think if these white nationalists were marching down my street with tiki torches that they grabbed from someone's backyard, I would be trying to defend my turf, and you mentioned it yourself, they are kind of trying to incite the violence. They know very well that's going to happen.
Right. And I think, a good friend of mine, I mean, I think we still have a good friend was actually there demonstrating peacefully. And she said, this is anecdotal, but I think it's got some validity to it, that large groups of people from both sides were not from Charlottesville. That they came in. Now, when I say both sides, let me be really clear here. There is no, equivalency to between Nazis and anybody else. Neo-Nazis, fascists, racism, anti-Semites. It was a polyglot group, but they were all hate mongers. There no way is those who countered them. But I don't find it hard to believe that in a heightened vitriolic environment of this kind of thing, that there would be scuffles and clashes and so on. On the other hand, they didn't go there with the intent of engaging in violence. When the other people show up with shields and guns and things like that, that is an intentionally threat posturing approach.
Yep.
And nobody who is there to protest the alt-right gathering, the Unite the Right gathering, killed anybody.
Tom Mikaitis is our guest, historian, author, teacher over at DePaul University, professor at DePaul University. He has several books out, The Iraq War Encyclopedia, The New Terrorism, Myths and the Reality, and many more. He's working on another one. If you have any questions or comments, we're easy to reach. We're at 312-981-7200. More in just a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Tom Mikaitis is our guest. We've had Tom on before. Always interesting to talk to him, a DePaul professor, terrorism expert, author of several books, including The Iraq War Encyclopedia, The New Terrorism, Myths, and the Reality. Do we have a title yet for the new book, Tom?
It's sort of like, understanding terrorism, terrorists, and terrorist organizations, understanding the threat. That's kind of the working title.
Not available yet, though. Right.
No, I had to write it first.
All right. I see how you work. All right.
Yeah, it's in process.
All right.
312-981-7200. Joe has a question for you. Professor Tom Mikaitis on the line with us. Joe, what's your question?
Hi. I've been in the military, and many of my family members before me have been in the military. I just find it hard to believe that this country will go and fight a war to eradicate Nazism and oppression against people of the country, or even threats against the United States. But they allow it to march down our streets and not do a thing about it. I mean, it's the people that are causing all this trouble didn't even live in Charlottesville. They were there for one purpose, was to instigate trouble with the people they knew were going to turn out to try to stop them. But I just can't believe we would let a lot of people die for this country to stop something that they're allowing to breed here.
Tom, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's very well said, and thank you for your comments, Joe. I think that the struggle is that I think people, one of the things that those people died for in World War II was the freedoms that we all hold, and I think it's a very delicate balance over freedom of expression and the right of the rest of us to be in a secure, safe environment. I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post over the weekend on this, and I think it's really time to have a serious conversation whether hate speech is truly covered by the First Amendment guarantee of free speech. Because at the time that was written, there was no internet. In the old days, there were filters in place. You know, a reputable publisher was not going to publish these things. Even the local newspaper required your letter to the editor to be articulate, factual, and respectful. Even if you disagreed with people, that was okay. This is a game changer. There are absolutely no filters now, and it becomes possible to just create this very, very, you know, supercharged kind of environment. But I think the response to this has been very positive. There have been peaceful responses. I think the move to take down this horrible iconography of secession and slavery, these statues, is actually moving. And I think there's something to celebrate here. These are southern cities, southern communities choosing to do this on their own. This is not a bunch of northern liberals running down to the south and tearing down the statues. So I think there are the response to this and the outrage has proven to be a pretty, you know, pretty positive thing.
Is there a better way to go about removing these icons, like trying to start a petition and do it instead of vandalizing it?
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what Charlottesville, in fact, is doing. In fact, the only thing that's slowing it up is a lawsuit that will probably fail, saying, well, you don't have the right to do this. Well, sure they do. The city council has a right to take down the statue, so it's going to come down. Others have come down in other places in the United States. There's absolutely no question that doing it the right way, the legal way, et cetera, is the appropriate response, just as peaceful protest is the appropriate response to these kinds of movements. I suggested, I think, if this Labor Day, next to our flags, we put up a sign like hate has no home here, or, you know, no matter where you're from, you're my neighbor. I mean, that's the kind of response that can, and I tried to buy that sign, by the way, and you can't because it's so far back ordered they can't possibly keep up.
Wow.
So I think you're really seeing a really grassroots counter response saying, these individuals do not speak for us.
Tom, did you live in or around Chicago in the 1970s?
No. I just heard a report this morning. Now, I was familiar. I was actually a grad student in Madison when the whole neo-Nazi movement and the attempted march through Skokie was going on.
Yeah.
But, of course, Madison is one of the most diverse cities, even at that time. So, yeah, I mean, but again, you know, that's also a thing to celebrate. You know, it was very much linked into this fear of integration, this fear of change. And it is essentially in that community pretty much evaporated. Chicago still has issues with segregation and still has issues with race and division and all kinds of stuff like that. But despite the work I do, or maybe because of it, I'm always a glass half full sort of person.
All right. Well, that brings me to the big question. Are we truly moving backwards?
No, I don't. I really don't think we are. It's a very interesting. People don't realize in the study of conflict and change that I've done in, you know, over 30 some years, I noticed something that others have commented on, that often things are most intense and sometimes most violent just on the eve of change. One of the bloodiest years in South Africa was the last year of apartheid. And I think that's something what you're seeing. This is not nearly that extent, but I think what you're seeing is that I'm seeing this in some ways as a last gasp of this fear of change. And the real issue, as I said, going back to my earlier comment, people can protest and advocate for white supremacy, et cetera. They cannot change the underlying demographic of America, which is the diversification, the intermarriage, the wonderful blending of humanity that is making us the strong nation we are. They can't do anything about that. That's not reversible.
Why can't you be our president?
Come on, Tom, just be our president. Come on.
I hate meetings. I'm an academic.
All right.
I can't stand committees. I can't stand meetings. You know, no, believe me, you don't want an academic president. You want a practical, pragmatic, not a theoretician.
I have to admit, you make me feel more hopeful after speaking to you. Hasn't he helped a little, Bill?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit. It's been, as you know, Tom, it's been a rough couple of days.
Yeah, I share that. I'm heartsick about what happened. And yeah, it has been a rough couple of days. But maybe what gives me hope is being a historian, because we take the long view of things.
I'll tell you how rough it's been, Tom. This is how rough it's been.
Yeah.
When Wendy and I talked about having you on, our goal was to talk about North Korea.
Yep.
And that didn't even come up. That's how rough the last
couple
of days.
So we'll get you next week to talk about should we be fearful of that.
Yeah, well, exactly. I'm always available to talk about cheerful and interesting things.
Right? All right, good.
Well, it looks like we should have you out every week then.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
We'll keep you on our power dial. Tom, thank
you
so much. We really appreciate it. It's Tom Mikitas, historian and author, all kinds of books, some of them not even written yet. The Iraq War Encyclopedia, The New Terrorism Myths and Reality, Iraq and the Challenges of the Counterinsurgency, and Osama Bin Laden, a biography. Thanks so much, Tom. Have a good rest of the week.
You too. Anytime.
All right. Take care.
All right. We have to talk to him next week about North Korea now, because that is really what our topic was supposed to be.
I know.
Because God knows what's going to happen over there.
Yeah, I know. All right. We'll take a quick break. We have news next, Steve with the news, and then more show. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and Dane Neal is usually on the road, but today he's in the studio. Hi, Dane.
I like that. I am in the studio, but, you know, I'm standing on a Segway, so I'm ready to be on the road. I have to stay mobile.
Your balance is very good.
You got to live the brand, Wendy.
Incredible balance. Yes, you have to live the brand. Dane's right, Wendy, once again. You've brought a very special guest in, and for a very special reason.
Well, when you talk about living the brand, Chicago's brand, when you think about it, you know, kind of the team photo, the baseball card, the business card from around the world, and now the great food city is Chicago's identity. It's really great to see. It's been a long time building, and now we're getting some of those validations. Bon Appetit, Condé Nast. Chicago is the American best restaurant city of the year, right?
Woo!
And New York
on.
Loves hearing
what
it, don't they? In New York, when they hear that, they go, yay.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there was some kind of, I don't know, mayoral bet, right? Where we send them this, they send us this. One of the best ways that we celebrate here is in our restaurants all around the city, 365 days a year. But the culmination of a lot of that, where the city comes together along with so many of our great food personalities, is Chicago Gourmet. It is 10 years. Bill, can you believe it?
I can't. I refuse to believe
Wendy,
it.
Wendy, do you believe it?
I don't believe it.
I don't believe it. Well,
it's
guy
been 10 years.
Who's believing it and living it and running a hand on the pulse of so much of it is in studio with us. He's the president of the Illinois Restaurant Association, Sam Toya. Sam, it's great to have you. You've been on a lot of times. This is the first time here in the Showcase studio. Welcome.
It is. It is. Thank you for having me. As you were saying, Chicago Gourmet, as I say, is one of the best food and wine shows in America. I don't care what they say in South Beach or Pebble Beach. It's right here, Millennium Park, every September. In
Sam,
Chicago.
What do you think the turning point was? As Dane just pointed out, this has become, if not the most premier city in America for food, one of them certainly. Why? What happened? What was the turning point?
Well, I think the turning point is, when Mayor Daley was in, he knew that culinary tourism was going up, and he thought doing a food and wine show would be a great idea for Chicago.
Because he liked to eat. Come on, admit it.
Absolutely. And he understood. You know, he was thinking out. He knew that look at what's going on in the West Loop. We have the greatest restaurants you could imagine in the West Loop, from Stuffy Eiser to Rick Bayless, to name a few, but these few celebrity chefs we have in the West Loop. But just, you know, the energy that we have here in the city of Chicago when it comes to the culinary scene. You know, the millennials love an experience, and we have the restaurant experience here in the city of Chicago. And we're bringing in visitors left and right. The back half of the plane's all about tourism. People look at what restaurant you have in that city. And we bring it all together at Chicago Gourmet every year. This is going to be our 10th year.
One of the things that's different about this, and I have attended covered broadcast from, you know, South Beach, New York, Aspen, so many of these different things. The thing about Chicago that is unique is that instead of just, and certainly we have plenty that are household names and celebrities, mm-hmm. instead of just kind of celebrity chefs, we have, and Sam mentioned it, the restaurants. Now, granted, those restaurants are kind of celebrities too when you think about the different ones attending, but it is a lot of those restaurateurs that participate so heavily in it. So it's less of kind of a, like a celebrity-based tourist attraction than it is kind of just showcasing and highlighting the best of what we're doing all the time here.
We have over 250 chefs that participate at Chicago Gourmet. Yes, from all over the city, from Avondale, Logan Square, Hyde Park, the West Loop, you name it. We have the chefs here participating in Chicago Gourmet. And this year we're doing 10 events because it's our 10th year anniversary. From, you know, from the Roby House in Hyde Park to the Italian Feast on the Riverwalk to the 606, with Rick Bayless. You know, we got some great things. And we're doing a ballpark fair goes gourmet at Wrigley Field. That's going to be our take on, you know, ballpark food, and we got some great chefs participating in it, like Jimmy Banos and Paul Kahan and Jeff Morrow and Jason Vincent of Giant. We just saw they were named one of the 10 best restaurants here in the country, right here in Chicago. He'll be participating. So we're looking for a great event at the Ballpark Fair Goes Gourmet. You got to get out there.
You're this like is, a proud this papa is, when oh, you yes. talk about
this event is yes. going to be off the charts.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Sam, the unique relationship the Illinois Restaurant Association has with this event. You know, so many of these events, they'll pick a charity partner or some kind of cause to support. But when we talked about having kind of that unique platform for restaurants to be the entertainment, Sam, talk a little bit about, of course, you're the president of the Illinois Restaurant Association. You're kind of the driving force behind it. Like, how does the association work with it? How does it support restaurateurs and people in the industry? I think that would be kind of
absolutely. So we do at the Restaurant Association, at the Illinois Restaurant Association, obviously we do advocacy. We're not crazy about that pop tax, but we won't go there right now. But anyway, we do advocacy, we do education, we do special events like Chicago Gourmet. We do the food and beverage at Taste of Chicago, which we had a great event this year at Taste of Chicago. We do like a chef's table where we raise funds for our Illinois Restaurant Association Ed Foundation. Last year we gave out $178,000 in scholarships. We work with CPS schools, Chicago Public Schools like Simeon and Fanger and Juarez and Roosevelt and Roberto Clemente, to name a few. So we're out there, you know, educating and promoting the next generation of restaurant leaders here in the city
Love
of Chicago.
See, as many things that may not always be as publicly functional in the state of Illinois, the restaurant industry is vibrant and thriving.
Oh, absolutely. We are the largest private sector employer here in the state of Illinois, with over 561,000 people working in the restaurant food service industry here in the state of Illinois. That's right. We do over $25.2 billion in sales, and we produce over $2 billion in sales tax to local municipalities and to the state.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Do me a quick favor. Dispel the myth. People hear gourmet, they go, oh, I bet that's snooty. That's for rich people. Not necessarily.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Like I said, it's this experience. You know, we got 10 different events this year, from, as I said, the Ballpark Fair Goes Gourmet, to how about Sweets and Beats on Wills Tower with the Ladies of Pastry with Mindy Siegel and many more. That is going to be really, really cool. And that's, you know, that's a reasonably charged event. So, yes, we want everyone coming to the Chicago Gourmet, or one of our 10 events we got going on, from the Hamburger Hop to After Hours Party. We got it all going on.
How come you did quotes around the Ladies of Pastry? What does that mean when you do quotes around them?
Ladies of Pastry, because that is going to be off the charts. Right. I'm looking forward to that event. So it's Sweets and Beats on Willis Towers with Mindy Siegel, and I'm really looking forward to that one. I don't know if I'm looking more forward to that or the Ballpark Fair Goes Gourmet. I'm trying to figure out which one I'm going to
It's not either or.
You have to pick one or the other.
We
talk Sophie's about Choice.
No, tough choices here. Just do it all. Talk about the restaurants being highlighted. Talk about some of the celebrity chefs. We're gonna take a break, I think, and we're gonna have one of the chefs that is one of the biggest stars in Chicago. Been there since the beginning. I think Graham Elliott is gonna be joining us when we come back. Talk Chicago Gourmet.
Thanks, Dane. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder, and it's WGN.
We are talking with Dane Neal. You can hear him on the road every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4, but you're with us now, and the president of the Illinois Restaurant Association, Sam Toya, is with us as well. And do we have to talk about something before we introduce our special guest on the phone?
No. I think we've talked about kind of the history of Chicago Gourmet, Chicago's premier culinary event, and in the 10th year, as it's become so big with so many other, you know, extra events going on, kind of taking over the city from the 19th to the 24th. A guy that has been there since the beginning is one of the biggest and brightest stars in the food world of Chicago or the country, right? You know him from MasterChef, you know him from Food Network, television personality, restaurateur, the one only. Graham Elliott is with us as well. He's going to be a big part of Chicago Gourmet. Graham, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, guys. How's everyone doing?
We're all amazed.
We're hungry.
We're hungry. Yeah, Wendy's right. It should cut to the chase. We're very hungry. Make us some mac and cheese, Graham. Please send it over. Fax it over.
Done.
All right. This is exciting. 10 years now for the Chicago Gourmet event. Can you believe it?
No, I can't. That's incredible when you think of, not just food in general and how it's evolved, but I mean Chicago in particular. Think of the restaurants, Michelin Guide, the, you know, Beard Awards. Obviously, Chicago Gourmet, events like that that Sam was speaking of. The city is absolutely the pinnacle of what's going on in food in the country.
Well, Graham, talk a little bit about the beginning. I know you're one of the founding chefs for Chicago Gourmet. I remember I've been there every single year. What comes to mind for 2008 was a lot of wines around the perimeter of Millennium Park. I remember Rick Bayless in the middle of what felt like an open field signing books, and now it has become this huge sold-out phenomenon for many, many years. Talk about the progression.
You know, I think what's really cool is you look at food and wine events that are around the country, and They're very similar where you, like you said, you've got, you know, booths and some wine, chefs giving like a little tasting portion of a dish, maybe a couple demos here and there. But Chicago Gourmet completely, embodies what Chicago's about by, you know, highlighting all the different ethnicities, chefs, you know, high, low, whatever you want to call it. But also think of that setting, you know, to be able to sit there and look around and know where you're at in the world. You know, with the architecture, the city, all that stuff. And of course, you know, the food and wine speaks for itself, and to see it change over 10 years. And like you said, you know, like Lollapalooza sells out as soon as tickets become available. Everyone talks about it, wants to go. Everybody hits me up asking for free tickets somehow, and I have to like upset them. And say,
that was my next question.
Yeah, Wendy wants free tickets.
I'd never made that connection, Graham, but maybe that you're the secret ingredient of both Lollapalooza and Chicago Gourmet.
No. That's Sam and the city and, you know, Mayor Emanuel and all those guys that, you know, do everything to make these things successful. You know, I'm a chef. All I know how to do is cook and talk to people, and being able to come out and do that side by side with.
And Graham, you know how to promote Chicago very well. We thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's true. When you think about it, for me, I've been lucky enough to, you know, do TV and events and all that kind of stuff. But what I say, you know, I have one restaurant, I have one home, my kids go to school, and everything is here in Chicago. So I think a lot of times, because, you know, of the exposure, people think like, oh, you live in LA or wherever, and what are you doing in Chicago right now? It's, you know, no, completely the opposite.
Well, we're gonna hear from Graham about what you're gonna do at Chicago Gourmet, plus this other exciting thing that's happening before we end the segment. Sam, I know that you wanted to mention some of the other events that are going on for Chicago Gourmet,
right?
Plus one right here in Trib Tower.
Exactly. So that kicks it off. It's the Cocktails on the Crown, and it's with all these great mixologists. Remember, they used to be bartenders. Now they're mixologists.
Right.
So it's right here at the Crown, and that kicks it off. But really, what I think is going to be one of our greatest events is the Ballpark Fair Goes Gourmet, Saturday night, September 23rd, at the Plaza at Wrigley. You know, it's all about Elevating the Ballpark Food, and we got some great chefs there like Jimmy Banos and Paul Kahan and Jeff Morrow and Jason Vincent of Giants. So we're really looking forward to that Ballpark Fairgoers Gourmet. And another one, this is a good one, Sweet and Beats on Willis Tower Sky Deck, Saturday after our dance party with Mindy Siegels and the First Ladies of Pastry. That's going to be a fun one as well.
And ChicagoGourmet.org is the website to get all the information on the schedules and the tickets and all those kind of things. Sam mentioned the ballpark. That is going to be a great event as well. So, Graham, let the listeners know what they can see you doing at Chicago Gourmet for sure. You're going to be doing some demos, I'm sure, and some food. And then also coming up, you're going to be doing a separate thing through this really awesome series that Wrigley is doing with the Chef Series.
Yeah, that's going on right now, and it'll be taking off till the 3rd of September. So, versions of ballpark food, with a little twist, and for me, anything that I can get my hands on as far as being involved with baseball, I jump at. So this has been super exciting.
Graham, my family and I during the summer tend to eat in restaurants that have an outdoor section. We just love eating outside in the summer. As a chef, are you doing anything differently when you know that the food is being enjoyed outside as opposed to inside?
Yeah, and you try to make it a little lighter and I guess a little easier to. For baseball in particular, I mean, they can use your hands to carry around. But with, at the restaurant, great cocktail scene, like Sam was saying, mixology, people are taking as much care in the drinks they make as the chefs do with the food that they're preparing. So that light, clean, really bright flavors, that's what we really try to focus on.
And for Chicago Gourmet, do you have anything like special that you're doing there? I know you're going to make some appearances. The fans will love to see you.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing my demos, and the big thing is, again, taking inspiration from Chicago. So I'm going to be doing like my version of a deep dish pizza, maybe my style of a Chicago dog, stuff like that.
It all sounds so good. We all have drool cups on right now, all four of us.
We try to cook and show people that, there's really no rules. You can make it whatever you want. So, a deep dish pizza could be an awesome tart of, confiere and tomato and taleggio and layer it all up with some, Italian sausage sliced up and roasted in between. You can do anything you want. You can make it whatever, as long as you take a bite and have that frame of reference and say like, okay, I close my eyes and I tasted it and I get the idea of deep dish, but this is totally different.
You're talking about things being more portable and potable when you're at the ballpark. What about a spaghetti taco? You can make a shell out of garlic bread and then put some kind of pasta in there. Not a bad idea?
No, let's do it.
You got to patent that first.
Wow. I like that.
Anything that incorporates pasta somehow, I think people go for.
All right, we got to work on that, Graham.
Done.
All right, so many great things. One of the great things about it is you hear some of the best and brightest personalities in Chicago, not only what they're going to do for these amazing events like Chicago Gourmet, but you hear the passion and love they have, the connection that they have with the city. It isn't just about themselves, what they're doing, what their restaurant is, how it ties in to kind of this greater picture. And in challenging times, guys,
yes,
this is a bright beacon of hope and sunshine and tastiness, right?
Puts a smile on your face and your stomach.
Absolutely.
At the same
Remember,
time.
We're the Restaurant City of the Year. Bon Appetit just said it earlier this week and last month. Condé Nast, they were the best restaurant city in the United States. Sorry, Los Angeles.
So ChicagoGourmet.org, right, Sam,
that's
for
right.
tickets and
that's
all the
right.
information.
Sam's gloating.
Pop the cork.
Dane.
We're 10. Pop right. the cork.
Thanks,
we're 10.
Graham.
Chicago Gourmet.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks.
And thank you, Dane.
You really
thank
appreciate
you,
it.
Am.
Yeah. I do not like them on a plane. I do not like them on a train. Thanks, guys. Greatly
thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll take a quick break and then some news coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Thank you, Kim. All right, guys, I want to talk fashion. Bill,
do I have to leave the room for this?
No.
I can stay?
You're the first person I thought of when I read this today.
Oh,
that's not good.
That always happens when there's a story about fashion.
Is this fashion don'ts?
Kim, that's hurtful.
I'm sorry,
that's
Bill.
That's hurtful, but accurate.
Did you have a members-only jacket?
Yeah.
Honest to God?
I did for a little while.
Not
just
still have
Anthony
it?
Geary. Yeah, because it'll come back.
It probably will. I think it did.
They were back for a while already.
Did they come back for a little while? Mm-hmm. Anthony Geary, who played Luke Spencer on General Hospital, was their spokes guy for a while. And people thought, well, if he's wearing one, these must be cool. We were wrong.
I'm going to mention a brand of jeans to you.
Is it Gerbeau?
No, but you're close.
Remember
Francois
those?
Gerbeau.
Yeah. They had their own shop here in Chicago. I used to go in every once in a while. Those were pants like you, for people who are too young to remember Gerbeau pants, they were pants for you. If you'd say to yourself, I wonder if at some point in my life I'll gain 180 pounds. I should get a pair of pants that will accommodate that.
This brand, too, and I'll bet you if you put your mind to it, you can guess. There is an 80s-style type of pant that was baggy and pleated.
Does it start with a Z?
Yes, I knew you'd know this.
I know these. Z Cavaricci or something? Is
you
that it?
Have either really disappointed me or made me very proud.
Oh,
because
well,
you're right.
It is. It's Z Cavaricci, right?
Wow, yes, Bill.
They're Thank coming you. Back.
Yep. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
No one will buy them.
Nobody will buy these.
Here's the deal. The distinctive pants were a hit when they debuted in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Exemplifying the excess of the era, they quickly became a must-have for a generation of young people. Now, James Cavaricci, where does the Z come from?
I don't know.
Why didn't he just say J. Cavaricci?
Because Z sounds exotic, doesn't it? Like J. Cavaricci, you go, yeah, I knew a guy, Z. I wouldn't get his pants, but Z. Cavaricci, that sounds exotic.
It's trendy. It sounds trendy.
Yeah.
James Cavaricci founded the brand in 1982 in Los Angeles, and he's hoping a new generation will embrace this oversized, puffy, looks like you're wearing diaper look.
They won't. That new generation will not happen.
He is self-funding the brand's revival with a limited edition anniversary collection of 500 women's pieces. Oh, you're out of luck.
No guys?
No.
Pants? Oh, this is upsetting.
They're priced from $225 to $245 for a pair of jeans.
That's not much of a price range.
No.
It's almost nothing.
It isn't.
Usually, you go, they start at $6 but go up to $3,000. But this guy, it's all in the same exact price range.
Well, the reason they're so expensive, they will be available in fine line twill and Japanese denim.
Oh.
They will be available exclusively online because no store will carry them.
I can't imagine a store going, yeah, we got to get those in stock immediately.
James Cavaricci says, I'm pretty confident that these will become collectibles immediately, and we're really very excited to launch them.
Mm-mm.
We already have plans in the works to expand the line into a men's and women's brand, bringing Z Cavaricci to a new audience, which I hear is already called Generation Z.
He'd be wrong on that.
So is he bringing it back because this is now Generation Z? He thinks Z Cavaricci. Have you? Can I just remind you of what they looked like?
I know exactly what they looked like.
They were definitely high-waisted jeans, which I will admit have come back into fashion.
And they're high-waisted because the people who wore them were either high or waisted.
Oh, they weren't.
They were a big club scene pants. Like
yeah,
you'd
but
always see people at the club wearing them, but it looked like they put. It looked like. Who was the guy who'd go, did I do that? Remember that guy on TV? That little kid?
No.
The kid who, he was like a nerd. He wore glasses and it looked like somebody pulled his pants up way too high. That's what they looked like.
Well, they were very high. And like I said, high-waisted pants.
A kid on
back.
Family Matters. I don't know. I can't
Urkel.
Remember. Urkel.
Oh.
It looked like if Urkel had his own line
they
of
do.
Designer jeans, it would be Z Cavaricci or E Cavaricci, I guess, for Urkel.
But they came up really high, and then they were very pleated.
Yeah.
So it really looked baggy, and boy, that's bringing back memories as I'm looking at the picture.
But look, all right, so look at that picture, and keep in mind, we went through a lot during that period. We didn't know what we were thinking. We just put stuff on because somebody told us it looked good. We're smarter now, aren't we? Would that same look work today? I don't think so.
Well, they were like a trouser kind of thing because they had a pleated front.
Yeah.
And as we've learned on this show many times, thin or heavy, pleated trousers make a man look heavier.
See, now I think almost the opposite.
Oh, God. They just add all this bulk. You want a flat front.
I agree with that. It makes you look puffy around the middle.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, it looks like you took a giant hefty garbage bag and then tied a string around it. It's all gathered and puffy like that under the belt.
I don't like it. I know they're going to market this toward kids mostly, right? Teenagers? Is that who they're shooting for on this?
Well, who's Generation Z? Do we know when that started?
I don't know the
is
exact
Kevin
years.
Generation X?
Kevin is napping right now. He's taking a short nap.
Because this is where I get confused, because we're not really baby boomers. We're kind of closer to baby boomers than we are Gen X, right?
Yeah. But I think their target audience is going to be people in their late teens and early 20s, I think, who weren't around the first time. Like a lot of times when a fashion trend comes back, it's bought into by people that didn't know what a disaster it was the first time. Like, we're all too smart now. We lived through this once. We know not to fall back into that trap.
But see, there are some things that came back into fashion that I bought into, like flare jeans. They were popular when we were in high school, so in the 80s. I loved them.
Late 70s into the 80s, right. Maybe, right?
Definitely late 70s, but it made, you know, I graduated in 81, so I was into the flare jeans, and then they went away, and now they call them boot cut, and they're very flattering.
Right.
And then I had this thing in high school. In fact, all of my girlfriends had it. Kim, I don't know if you would remember this, but it was a landlubber bib top skirt.
What?
It was denim.
It was
and
all
it had
one piece?
Yeah. It had a bib top like overalls. And then it was like a jean skirt and it was kind of long.
Oh, I think I know what you mean.
Oh, my God.
Was it one particular brand name or were there several different
landlubber.
It was landlubber?
And we all would have them and we all would call each other the night before. And if the line was busy because there was no call waiting, and it was usually a rotary dial, we would call and say, okay, today's the landlubber day. Oh, are you going to wear them with your Candy's slides? Candy's shoes they looked like Barbie shoes. They'd just slide on your feet with a high heel, and we'd all wear it the same time, the same day.
On purpose?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, interesting. And how old were you guys when you did this?
In high school.
Oh, all right.
I sprained my ankle with those shoes.
They
were dangerous. High. Very dangerous.
What color were yours? Mine were beige.
Mine were beige also.
Oh, there you go.
Kind of a taupe, actually.
Yeah,
mine were
exactly.
Darker.
Neutral. They go with any color landlubber you might want to put on that day.
Hi, Peg. How are you?
Hi. I'm thinking this is the same time my son was in that age group. And they used to wear these fat pleated pants. And then they bend over to the ankle area of the pant leg. And in order to make it narrow, you know, like a tighter ankle fit.
Yeah.
They would fold it over sideways on itself, you know, vertically.
Right.
And then they'd roll it up like three or four rolls.
So it would go in at the ankle, and that's exactly what this picture entails. You can Google search it, new Z Cavaricci jeans.
Yeah, and that's how they would wear those pants that were fat on the top. They'd make the ankle narrow. And then they'd roll it up, and then just to add insult to the look already, the guys would pull their white crew socks over the top of that.
Oh my God.
So you had your gym shoes, and then your white crew sock up a little bit taller over the rolled Z Cavaricci pants. Pretty ugly.
I remember those tube socks though. I loved those. They were white tube socks, and they had two colored stripes.
Two bands of color.
Oh,
the
I
top.
Loved them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's my memory of it.
Wow.
Well, they're coming back for 225 to 245. That's the range.
Yeah, won't be in our grandchildren's house, I don't think.
Good.
Thanks, Peg.
Thanks. Bye.
The way they're rolled up looks like, do you ever see like a guy who works at a car wash, he'd roll his sleeves of his T-shirt up and keep a pack of Salems in there? That's what it looks like to me. But it's with your legs instead of your arms.
You never rolled them up?
I was never fortunate enough to own a pair of Z Cavaricci.
You had your Francois
Gerbeau. Yeah, I had those.
With your members only jacket?
Not at the same time. You never want to look too good, Wendy. You want to pace yourself. The shop that was here, I'm trying to remember exactly where it was.
It was on Michigan Avenue, wasn't it?
Old Town. Was it in Michigan Avenue? Was it?
I could have sworn there was one at Water Tower Place, but maybe.
I don't remember that one, but I remember when I'd go there, like they had regular Gerbeau pants, which for people who don't remember them, were on the almost genie side, right? They were really big, but then they had like an upper scale brand of them, still Gerbeau, that were even puffier. like the big ones weren't big enough for somebody. They wanted to get an extra puffiness to them.
Marité Francois Gerbeau.
Maybe.
You know what? Let's take a break here, and we might be tapping into a vice presidential speech.
Oh, really?
So I don't
about
think
about these pants.
Yeah,
about
the
Z Cavaricci pants.
Hey, Obama wore mom jeans. You know that.
I remember. All right, that's coming up next. It's Phil and Wendy on WGN.